everybody, welcome back to the Beyond the Peloton podcast. I'm your host, Spencer Martin from the Beyond the Peloton newsletter. I'm here with Andrew Vaughn to the Choose the Hard Way podcast, thebetterlab.io. We are breaking down the Tour Flanders, which was this last weekend. And if you live under a rock, Matthew Vanderpool won it with a pretty impressive solo effort. We will discuss how that happened. What does this mean? Was this inevitable? As well as some odd stuff going on at the Tour of the Basque Country. I hope everyone is keeping an eye on this race. You never know what it's going to do, as well as a few other odds and ends. But Andrew, before we get into it, do you want to plug anything?
Yeah, absolutely. Right before we get into the UAE's 15 secret feed spots at Flanders, Choose the Hard Way is the podcast about how hard things build stronger humans who have more fun. My most recent guest, alpinist, National Geographic photographer Corey Richards. Come check us out everywhere you listen at choosethehardway.com and at HardwayPod on social. And if you're someone who would like to get better sleep so you're rested for the things you love, like riding bikes, then check out thebetterlab.io. We help you build mindful science-backed practices to sleep better. Come check us out.
Well, we need to do a corrections corner before we get started, because we slandered Jonathan Kaplan of Riding Wet's name last week. He said he did not have Flow bikes. He reached out. He does have Flow bikes as of Sunday to watch the Tour of Flanders, and he shared important information. We were spreading misinformation last week. They do allow you to sign up for a monthly membership now. So I think it's $12.99 a month. You can get that. You can cancel. I would probably keep it through, or you could cancel, sign up again in August, because you're going to say, World Championships, what an amazing race. I can't wait to watch that. Oh, wait, it's not on anything. It's on Flow. Wait, I don't have Flow. So, you know, that's something to keep in mind. Those are the big two races, Flanders and World Championships. They probably has something to do with the lawsuit that people couldn't cancel. So they added some sort of monthly option. I would bet that's related. Other correction corner. Someone reached out on Instagram. Instagram hit me up on DM. I'll come back at you. I'm active on those things. But they pointed out something I hoped people would forget. I vaguely recall this, that I said Matthew Vanderpool was making a big mistake with his cyclocross schedule, going to Worlds, not racing early road stuff, resting, doing San Remo and only two races before Flanders. This person pointed out that, yeah, he actually did pretty well at Flanders and seems to be on pretty good form right now. Andrew, the premiums on this take could bankrupt me if I don't just cash out the losses right now. What should we do? Should we just keep riding this through the rest of the year? Should we concede defeat? What are your thoughts on this?
Something bad could be just around the corner for MVDP. I mean, like, I think you keep riding the take. I also want to point out that another reason to have Flow bikes, it's not just for Worlds. It's for the outside chance that we see Scott McGill back on rim brakes at the World Championships in 2024. Who knows?
Still on that tarmac. He's actually having a good year. He won a race recently.
Yeah, he's all over the place. You know, he's a multi-surface professional now, and he's racing in Europe. And hunting. He's doing it all.
And hunting. He won a race at the Tour of Rhodes
the classes of
fame. Yeah. Yeah. Very impressive, actually. But to get us back on track, Matthew Vanderpool, yes. So he won Flanders. Really impressive. He has Roubaix coming up this weekend. We'll probably win that, actually. Amstel Gold, pretty interesting race schedule. Amstel Gold, Liège. I'm very curious to see how he does in those two races. And then the next thing on his schedule is World Championships. I assume he's doing the Olympics in there. But maybe the secret to, let's say this is successful. I would say the secret to his success, and I hate it that he does it, is not doing the Grand Tours. You know, that might be his saving grace if he can kind of manage his efforts and not do the Grand Tours. On the flip side, he could say, no one's ever won the Olympics without doing a Grand Tour beforehand. So that could hurt him. But I mean, this guy is incredible. I'm kind of tired of doubting him at this point. I guess we'll walk through the early stages of Flanders. I turn it on with like 150K to go. And then by 114K to go, people are attacking. Our guy, Jonas Abrahamsson from UnoX, who got second at Dwarves, the guy famously gained like 25, 30 pounds and got a lot better. So that's the new trend, Andrew. Everyone's going to be bulking up to try to challenge for these cobbled classics. But he's attacking. Alpecin has a rider go with them, Axel Lawrence. I thought that's pretty clever because if they can get a rider up the road, they don't have to work all day, frees them up to do other stuff. But then Mateo Jorgensen says, hold on, not so fast. I'm going to start attacking with 111K to go and is unleashing like major moves on climbs. I thought this is interesting, but I think for that to work, they needed Wout Van Aert there because Mateo Jorgensen was the leader because they either didn't have Wout Van Aert because of injury. And a lot of the other guys you would think would be their leaders were just not on form, sick, like Laporte. Dylan Van Baarle's been struggling a bit this year. Tejs Benoot, maybe not at his very best. So Jorgensen was like doing the early attacks and then also trying to be their leader. Same thing with Mats Pedersen at Little Trek, was attacking a lot, trying to put Vanderpool in tough positions, like a tough situation where he had to make a decision. Do I go in this small group and lead my team, or do I sit back and hope my team can pull these guys back? Turns out the guy has got ice in his veins these days. Like he's no longer the Vanderpool of frantic decisions. He just kind of sat there and said, I don't have any teammates with me right now, but they'll come back because they have these handy little skewers on their bikes and all these flat tires were suffering. They can just take their wheels off and have the wheel off before the team gets there. The mechanic can put the wheel on. We're fast at changing wheels. They'll be back. And they got back. They launched him up to the front group. And I mean, I think people maybe thought this was weird, but I thought it was kind of genius. They had a rider go, Gianni Vermeersch, go with Mads Pedersen, who tried to attack. Instead of just sitting on his wheel, he works with them, which you would think, well, this is violating every rule of bike racing. You should sit on the breakaway when it's a rival of your teammate. But he worked with them while his Alpecin team was working in the group behind. The idea here is they were holding the gap at a manageable, something that he could bridge later, but also extending Pedersen's time out front by helping him to tire him down. They hit the final circuits. Pedersen's shot by that point. Unclear to me why Pedersen did that. He said he didn't have the acceleration because of the crash. So maybe he was
bad doomed sensations.
Doomed anyway. Yeah, the sensations were not good. I would say if you could like be off the front at Tour of Flanders for 35 kilometers, maybe the sensations were good and you should have just rested until the Koppenberg or sat in until the Koppenberg. But Vanderpool goes on the second pass of the Haut-Clermont. Didn't drop everybody, kind of surprisingly. He looked a little bit off to me all day, to be honest, which sounds ridiculous because he won the race solo. Then he I think he made a decision of like, all right, well, I'm not going to get rid of these guys before the Koppenberg. So I'm going to just be at the front of the Koppenberg. I'm going to use my cross skills to go up this super slick climb. He almost slipped out. I don't know if you saw that. He gets up and over first. Jorgensen second, but Jorgensen shot because he just put in all that work early in the race. Pedersen third, Pedersen shot because he put in all that work early in the race. Everyone else has to walk up because one guy stops. And if one guy stops in the Koppenberg, has to put a foot down, everyone's putting a foot down. Everyone's walking. Race is over right there because if a group is walking while Vanderpool is riding, he'll probably be able to take advantage of that gap. I thought he looked like he was cracking at the end. I mean, he was dying in the final 13 kilometers after the last pass of the Paderberg. Wins by a minute. And then we get weird stuff where Luca Mazzotto gets second. I mean, I can't imagine what the odds on that would have been pre-race. Mazzotto for a podium. Niels Paulet third. Also would not have bet on that. Michael Matthews relegated. I thought a little harsh. That would have been a good result for him. Those guys were so tired, they didn't know what they were doing. And they relegated him for deviating from his line. But I don't know. Felt a little ridiculous to me. So that's the race. I guess now we should go through, like, Vanderpool's done this race 6 times, never finished below 4th, and finished 5 consecutive podiums, and now has won the race 3 times, which ties the all-time record. I think he's the third rider all-time to win it 3 times in 5 years, but he's the first one since the 70s. I mean, this is essentially impossible in modern cycling, and he has the best ever like career average finish for someone's that, let's say, started a minimum of 6 Flanders. So the question we're asking is Matthew Vanderpool the best cobbled racer of all time? I mean, if he wins Roubaix this weekend, we probably have to start asking that question.
Yeah, potentially. And I think something that we don't want to overlook here is the power of the spirit of the gravel at Flanders over the weekend. So we had Vermeersch out there for a while with Pedersen in the men's race. Also, he ends up finishing, let's see, where was he? He was 23rd, 241 back. Great result, given his team leader won the race. And he spent quite a bit of time out there with old Mads Diesel. And then in the women's race, we had Kaja Nui-Adoma, former gravel world champion, also doing quite well, but not the step of the podium that she would have hoped for. And that women's race was a hell of a race.
If you could say better than the men's race, actually.
Yeah. So if you missed that one, definitely go back, watch the replay on Flow Bikes. Spencer, I don't know if you noticed this, but in the both in the sprint for the victory and then in the sprint of the group one group back in the women's race, there was actually a line deviation that was directly analogous to what we saw with Michael Matthews' line deviation, and nothing happened in the women's race. So I thought that was curious. It was almost identical.
I mean, if you were like more cynical, you'd say, let's see the betting action on this. Like, did someone have action on Paulette finishing third? Because it seemed a little harsh. I mean, I guess what we should, the big takeaway from this race, other than the fact that Vanderpool is amazing, it was so hard. I mean, 6 hours and 5 minutes, it's the fastest Flanders of all time. It was all out pretty much all day. And it's not like these guys finished and were like, fine. They were trashed. Vanderpool won and he was trashed. The sprint for second, no one knew what they were doing. I mean, it was a sprint of zombies. They're just all over the road. That's why I kind of disagree with the deviation, because Paulette wouldn't have passed him anyway. No one was getting around anyone. Mazzotto actually did get around Matthews for second, but I don't know. It's like, whatever. At the end of 6 hours, go wherever you want to go on the road. If you don't want to get pinned against the barriers, don't be next to the barriers. This is not a bunch sprint at the Tour de France, in my opinion. That's how it should be. But I guess other takeaways too are UAE finishes third, fourth, and fifth. Fifth is a 20-year-old, which is pretty impressive. You have to wonder, the kind of the bittersweet thing about this men's Flanders is you're thinking, okay, that's impressive. But the only two guys who could ride with Vanderpool on a course this hard were not at the race. Wout van Aert for injury, Tadej Pogacar for reasons somewhat unknown. I guess he's preparing for the Giro, but come on, dude. You could helicopter in for this thing. Maybe he thought he needed to do preparation races and that would have affected his Giro training, but he's good enough. He could probably just race Flanders, give Vanderpool a run for his money, and that's it. I guess maybe he didn't want to crash or something, but I don't know. I'm not in a good place about that. I wanted Pogacar at this race, but you wonder, with UAE that good, you're just like, man, if they had their actual best rider, their leader, they probably could have done pretty well at this race and maybe pressed Vanderpool a bit.
Yeah, Pog perhaps still a bit burned from his experience at LBL in 2023.
That was a bit of a bummer for him.
Yeah, and the impact that it had on things like the Tour de France, you know. But I do think it's worth thinking about, and perhaps people have thought about this already, but what we saw happen with Wout recently, what we saw happen with Pog in 2023 at LBL, which certainly made it more difficult for him to be at his best at the Tour and probably scuttled his chances at the victory. We have to remember that, you know, it seems like he's immune to these types of things. I don't know what Jonas's race schedule looks like leading up to the Tour. And we know Roglic, of course, is best friends with the ground. So something's likely to happen to him between now and the Tour.
He actually doesn't crash as much anymore, as much as you would think, actually.
Yeah, he's
kicking the habit.
Yeah, he does have a ground and pound style, and what he's pounding is himself against the pavement typically. Anyhow, it seems like it's a foregone conclusion that Jonas is going to win the Tour. If not him, perhaps GC Sepp steps up. And, you know, anything can happen in bike racing, and that's part of why this is such an amazing and beautiful sport. Anything, including Antonio Morgado taking fifth place. We see Magnus Sheffield at Flanders with a hell of a ride in six, 102 down. And, you know, Spencer, we were also talking about some other riders who've had some, American riders who've had some very high placings in the classics the past few seasons, not in this race. What do you think is going on?
Well, we should say, so Magnus Sheffield, really good result. I think he's 21, and I'm like, oh, he's back on track. He's 21, and he's getting back. But yeah. I guess he spoiled us because he won a classic at 19 years old. But it is good to see him up there.
How about that?
Riley Sheehan in 13th place. Really impressive, because Riley has never raced a monument before. And there's probably not many riders outside of the freaks like Vanderpool and Van Aert and Pogacar who can finish top 15 in their first ever monument. That's really impressive. But So Mateo Jorgensen does not equal his top 10 finish last year. He's finished 31st. Let's give him a little bit of a pass because he was trying to be his own domestique and his own leader. We should unpack that a little bit later too, because when he went to Jumbo or Visma, everyone said, what a mistake, because he's not going to have any leadership chances. And then he gets to the Tour of Flanders and it's like, hey man, can you perform the role of five riders? Because we have no one left on this team. It's kind of funny how that ends up working out. And that happens more often than not, where people get freaked out that they won't have leadership opportunities. But outside of Ineos, that isn't as big of a problem as people think. But then Nielsen Palace, he got, I believe he got fifth or sixth here last year. Not at this race, not had a good season, has kind of a mysterious knee injury, or like, I guess, what do you say, inflammation in his patella?
Not good.
Am I imagining things, Andrew? Or I thought the whole point of cycling was that it's like less stress on your joint. So if you have knee problems, you can ride. But now these non-contact knee injuries seem to be a bigger issue. Is this positions? What's happening with this?
You know, I'm open to wildly speculating. I wonder if we might be seeing this as a result of riders changing crank lengths, which has become quite popular here the past few seasons. Riders tend to be going with shorter and shorter crank lengths, which we've gotten into in a couple of episodes back. We talked about this. In fact, I read recently that Pidcock had been experimenting with the shorter crank length. And what did we see happen to Pidcock yesterday?
Hold on. I think that's a little unrelated. He did get blown off his bike. I don't know. Maybe if he had a longer crank, he'd have a lower center of gravity. That wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, potentially. Nonetheless, when you modify your position on the bike and your biomechanics, it's often the case that you end up getting some soft tissue injuries, specifically in the knee. And I feel like I'm hearing about this more and more often, that riders are having knee-related irritation, meniscus, fluid in the knee, this type of thing.
Yeah, like a lot. I feel like this never used to happen. It is a little freaky with I recently just shortened my crank, so I'm down to 170, because I thought I can push a higher gear at a lower, because what happens is when you shorten your cranks, you just naturally increase your cadence. That's why you see, if you look at people's Strava files for the last hour of races after they attack, like Pogacar and Evenepoel will put out, you know, like 99 RPM averages for an hour. That's partly because their cranks are so low. But I do kind of, now that you mentioned that their cranks are so short, I kind of wonder if shortening the cranks and spinning more, you would think that's easier on your knee. I wonder if it's kind of increasing the angle, you know, it's almost tightening the angle your knee is at, and if that's causing issues. I mean, we've no freaking idea what we're talking about, so don't listen to us, anyone. But
yeah,
it is curious that this is happening as cadences are on the rise.
Yeah, the angle of your knee would actually be slightly more open. Your hip angle might be tighter, and if you're spinning at a higher cadence, you are going to, it's more revolutions per minute. So that is potentially
more knee action, I guess.
Yeah, potentially more knee action. And beyond that, it's just something different than what these guys have been doing millions of times per year for the past however many years.
I thought you were going to say for millions of years before this.
For millions of years before the dinosaurs appeared 5,000 years ago.
Is Vanderpool the best Flanders racer since T-Rex? We don't know. But yeah, where the heck were we? I guess I should say, as we're here, Ineos, kind of a good recovery for the classics. Sheffield sixth, someone else, yeah, we talked about it last week, Josh Tarling was really impressive at this race, you know, covering those early moves, finishes 17th. But the fact that we're even talking about like Tarling and Vermeesch, these guys that were covering moves early and finished in the top 25, shows you how hard this race is. Like, everyone was just gone after, like, the race was breaking up with 100K to go. And George Hincapie said about Flanders, like, you can just never give up. You can think you're off the back and in a hopeless position, and if you just keep riding, kind of like Mazzato, you might finish on the podium. Just keep riding at Flanders, because the race is so difficult that people will come back to you. I mean, it's actually, imagine that Vanderpool flats, Luca Mazzato wins this race, which is almost inconceivable to imagine.
I'm just still marveling at Michael Matthews' season thus far. And let's see, 1996, man, like late in his career, 34, basically.
I know. And he's never, that's his best career. Let's pretend he got third. That'd be his best career result at Flanders. Not traditionally not a great cobbled racer, like a better Ardennes racer. But kind of what I attribute this to, my crackpot theory here is, as the races get harder, they actually benefit Michael Matthews, even as he ages, because he's always been a guy who can sprint. You know, he's fast, but not the fastest. He's a good climber, but not the best climber. But as these races just get so hard, you know, he's left and he can sprint and get these good results, like second at Sanremo,
right,
third at Flanders, that maybe he couldn't get in the past because the races were more tactical and took a different skill set. Like positioning on the climbs is probably a little bit less important now because you're entering the final circuits at Flanders with a group of 20 as opposed to like a group of 70. So there could be something to that. We should also say Vanderpoel wins his first monument in 2020. So in the last 5 years, that's crazy. That was 5 years ago. He's won 5 monuments, tied with Tadej Pogacar for the most monuments of any active rider. That's a lot of monuments to win in 5 years. And he's not done. He could win more even this spring. Really impressive. But then one thing I've been thinking about Vanderpoel, and probably at this point, the debate is over. It feels crazy because I feel like the debate just started. Who's the better racer, Vanderpoel or Van Aert? I still think Vanderpoel can do things, or Van Aert can do things that Vanderpoel cannot. Like Van Aert finished second at Tirreno Adriatico behind Pogacar, ahead of like Geraint Thomas and other GC riders. I don't think Vanderpoel could do that. Van Aert does stuff at the Tour that I don't think Vanderpoel can do. But in terms of actual results, especially in one-day races, it's debate over. I mean, Vanderpoel has 5 monuments. Van Aert has won. Vanderpoel's won this race 3 times. He's won Roubaix. Van Aert's won none of those. And you kind of go back. If you go back to each individual year, you just say like, oh, it's a little bit of bad luck from Van Aert. Oh, we got COVID. He can't race Flanders. Oh, we crashed. He can't race Flanders. Oh, we got a flat at Roubaix. He didn't contest the finish. But it kind of makes you realize a lot of these narratives pop up over the course of the career. It's just a collection of little tiny things that could have gone one way or another. And then 5 years go by and you're like, oh, wow, I'm getting blown out of the water by my rival because little things aren't going my way. Like, do you think this is just bad luck, or are these little tiny decisions, like are these little tiny things, are they just the product of decisions from Van Aert that he could be making different ones? Like, maybe don't crash at E3. Maybe don't crash at Dwarves. Like, Mateo Jorgensen didn't. It seems to be possible, but he always seems to be in the wrong place at the wrong time for these one-day races.
I think that we could turn to the Hagakure here for some ancient wisdom. And it says, it is bad when one thing becomes two. One should not look for anything else in the way of the samurai. And I do think about this when I
reflect. Did you have this pulled up?
Something I've been thinking about.
So just ready to go. Wow.
Yeah. I have been, I know we talked about this a bit on the last episode, but if you take a look at Wout this season, and I personally have not put him on a scale in front of me, so I don't know what he weighs. He just looks less muscular. The guy looks like he has cut muscle weight similar to Ghana, right? So we've seen Ghana's definitely like shed some pounds of muscle. Wout looks like that as well, and he's doing it with the aim of becoming a GC rider. I think he also made the decision to become a Volcano person almost full time, and I think we've seen some of the second and third order consequences of pursuing something bigger. If you think of being a GC rider as bigger versus what we're seeing Vanderpoel do, which is he's going to be the best rider ever of cobbled classics probably, and you know, by the way, he also took a cyclocross world championship a couple of months ago. And who knows?
He's going to win like 7 or 8 cross world championships.
Yeah.
He might have 7.
Yeah, completely. And I'm thinking about the times we've, you know, some of the seemingly erratic riding that we've seen from Vanderpoel at Grand Tours. And we've commented, I mean, it just seemed like he was training in those events most of the time. And then he would occasionally do a really spectacular ride, take a stage win, but it's all somehow the rider who seemed to have the most talent and be the least strategic is now seemingly one of the most strategic riders doing the very most with the talent that he has, you know? So it's been a remarkable turn of events. And then with Wout, and I've reflected on this with Remco as well, and with what's happened with Quickstep, is they move in this direction of like, we're a GC team. We're organized around Remco. I don't think Remco is ever going to be able to deliver on that promise. And, you know, like, look at Flanders. Where's Quickstep in this race?
this was like well trodden over on the move after the race. I think they were pretty surprised at how bad Quickstep was. Like they're just anemic in these races. But in my mind, it's a product of 5-6 years of the decision making. You know, Pat Lefevre didn't want to spend. So every time he'd have a good classics rider, he wouldn't spend to keep him, except in the case of Alaphilippe and Askren, who suddenly are not as good after he spends a bunch of money to keep them. Oops, that didn't work out the way he wanted. But, you know, he was really flying close to the sun. He would just cut guys that were getting older, but he wasn't replacing them. That was the problem, you know, and then the core of the team just got older. Like Yves Lampaert is their top rider in 18th place, but he's been, you know, he was like fourth, fifth, sixth fiddle when that team was good, and now he's their leader. Like, that's a problem. You know, when your sixth man is now the best player on the team, that's not a great sign. But, you know, they are. They're consciously shifting. The team is built around Remco Evenepoel. They're probably going to win Liège, and then Lefevre can say, look, we won Liège. It was a successful spring. And then, as you say, I couldn't agree more about Remco. It's ridiculous because he's won a Grand Tour, so it's easy to say, what are you talking about? He's a Grand Tour rider. He won that race. But if you go back, and I realize I sound like a tinfoil conspiracy theorist, but if you go back, you'll say like, there was no climbs over 25 minutes of that race. It wasn't a real Grand Tour. And then you get to the Tour, climbs are 35, 40, 50 minutes, maybe even longer than that in some cases. And he's just never proven that he can handle days where there's multiple big climbs. We saw it at the Vuelta this year, where he just imploded on the day that had the most multiple big climbs. So they've taken a big risk. I think maybe the decision was made for them when they decided, let's keep Remco. And then Remco said, I want to be a GC rider. They said, all right, that's what we're going to do. My question for you is, and Remco is at Basque Country this week, and I'm glad he is, because that's going to be a fun race. But should he have been at this race? Like, what is this decision that he's just like, I don't race cobbled classics. I'm not a cobbled racer. I only race a few Ardennes and some stage races.
Like, yeah, I get why he's not there. I get why Pog's not there. And as a fan of the sport, they should absolutely be there. And I feel that it's a mistake, and it shortchanges us as fans of the sport not to have the very best riders there. You know, we didn't get the Vanderpool showdown that we wanted. We're not going to get it at Paris-Roubaix either. And I'm curious, Spencer, if you think we're going to see Vanderpool take Paris-Roubaix, of course.
Well, it's a great question. I will just to comment on what you just said. It stinks, you know, because even if they're not specialists, Evenepoel and Pogacar, they're good enough that they, and actually I think this is a really good course for Evenepoel. These climbs, yeah, and the circuits would suit him really well. Like, if you imagine Evenepoel chasing down an exhausted Vanderpool, like, that would have been incredible to watch in the final 30K. And I wouldn't put it past Evenepoel to be able to do that and just blow by him and win the race. But it is risky, you know, especially a rainy cobbled race. That's not exactly what you want to do before going into trying to prepare for a Tour de France. But on to Paris-Roubaix, which is this Sunday on Peacock, everybody. So we had Flow Bikes last week and Peacock this week, and in the United States. If you're in Europe, it's all on Discovery Plus. Roubaix is a different race. You know, Vanderpool was never almost, it would be impossible for him to have been beaten on Sunday unless he panicked early, rode away with Pedersen, left his team, and then he bonks in the end and Mazzato or Pollitt pips him for the win. At Roubaix, it's a lot more open race. And I actually, unpopular opinion, I don't like Roubaix as much because it is so chaotic and a bit random, because the cobbles are brutal. The race is flat, which is interesting because it opens it up to more people. So you have Niels Pollitt finishing third at Flanders. He's never going to be able to match Vanderpool in the climbs at Flanders. You know, he can potentially match Vanderpool on the cobbles at Roubaix. You know, it's like how we saw John Degenkolb there in that final group. You know, he's never going to be in that final group at Flanders, but he could at Roubaix because it's flat and watts per kilo don't matter. You know what matters? Watts. So someone like Old Ghana, Jonathan Milan, Niels Pollitt, like, those guys are massive. So they are Josh Tarling, potentially Riley Sheehan, a little bigger, Magnus Sheffield. So those guys could potentially match Vanderpool on the cobbles. It's going to be a harder race. Vanderpool could have bad luck. I think we're going to see an outsider. I know I said this about Tim Wellens last week, but, you know, like, Niels Pollitt, I wouldn't write someone like him off. next week. I think it's going to be tougher for Vanderpool. What do you think?
I have my own Morgado.
Morgado, a 20-year-old Portuguese rider.
Yeah.
No, I kind of wonder if fifth
Bring at the Flanders heat.
Is the best finish from a Portuguese rider of all time at Flanders. I don't know, man. Roubaix in his first time doing Roubaix. That would be impressive. He is bringing the heat. He's not that big, surprisingly, but clearly talented.
Yeah, he's listed at what? He's listed at 71 kilos, probably a bit lighter than that.
I mean, you look at Paulet. This is pre-COVID, so it's maybe lost to the sands of time. He did get second at Roubaix in 2019.
Right.
So the pedigree is there. I was kind of blown away by that third. You look at a guy, an 80-kilo guy, getting third at one of the... It is the hardest race. I mean, I talked to Riley after the race, and he said it's harder than you could have imagined it being. It was that hard. So if he could get third there, I don't know. I think... Obviously, Vanderpool will be the favorite, but don't sleep on someone like Paulet.
Yeah, a lot of people say that it's the Morgul Pismark of the classics.
It is. Oh, man. I still have nightmares about that race.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, before we completely move on from Flanders and wrap this up here in a minute, Spencer, I wanted to see if you had any take on probably one of the most contentious issues at Flanders, which, of course, was the prevalent of 50s tinge throwback fashion. I don't know if you saw the Visma Lisa bike letter jackets they were wearing that had like a rock on hand symbol with the tagline was pedal strokes speak louder than words. And then we had EF in, I think that they were supposed to be throwback kits. I'm not sure what they were throwing back to a time before they had like a wild color. Style. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I didn't notice a like throwback. But I'm like, well, it's just black and pink. Is that really throwback? I liked the black EF kits. I thought they were cool. They looked really good.
Dignified.
The letter jackets need to go. And Daniel Freebe, the cycling podcast, even proposed new rule that whatever you sign in with, you have to race in. So this cannot happen in the future. And I second that. Would also, is this like cultural appropriation? Would this be like us showing up in like berets to sign in for a race? Yeah. They're just like stealing the letter jacket.
The thing that I thought that this was a throwback to Sagan's 2016 victory and the infamous specialized grease video. I thought maybe they were going to, you know, we know how popular TikTok and dancing are now for professional cyclists. I thought like, is this the moment? Have they been working on a routine?
Just in tribute to Peter Sagan. If TikTok was around in 2016, Sagan would be the most famous person on the planet because of that video. But should we just talk about drama, and then I have to sum up the first stage of the Basque Country for everyone in like 30 seconds because it's amazing. But SD Works, the dominant team of last year on the women's side, like I would say too dominant to the point where it was hurting the race, to have two of the best riders in the world, Lotto Kopecky, Demi Vollering. And I'm going to need your help on the backstory here. I just knew there was some tough negotiations going on between Vollering and the team, and that Vollering and Kopecky were not planning to stay together in the future. I think anyone who watched Strada Bianchi last year and saw them yelling at each other at the finish line would know that's not surprising. But they just totally lay an egg at this race. Just outridden. You know, don't have the legs to be where they need to be. They just kind of get worked over by Little Trek in the finale. Little Trek has two riders in the final group of three. Easy peasy. They win, get third. Kasia gets second. She's on Canyon Tram. But Andrew, what's going on with this Vollering contract situation?
My read on it is that the team just wanted to dump her and make it look like it was her fault or the fault of her agent for demanding too much money. I think that when you see a situation like this, the team put out a public statement on social media that basically said, we gave an offer with an exploding deadline. So there was an expiring deadline on the offer they had made. And they said, you know, they didn't respond and counteroffer. Therefore, we're really sad that this isn't going to work out. That's not typically what you want to do if you want to retain talent. That's saying we're very grateful that we found some way to fire you. And goodbye. And we made it look like it's potentially your fault or like your agent bungled this.
Well, I think what I heard a few months ago is she got an offer from the UAE of €1 million a year, which is not
pretty good.
Not what she's making currently.
Yeah.
So if that set the market price and she always had that option. And she's leaving the team next year. We don't know where she's going. She could be going to UAE. She's going somewhere where she's probably getting paid about €1 million a year. I'm sure the team just said, well, we're not going to pay that. We can't afford that. And then started to think, well, how can we just then not try to pursue her without it looking bad on us? Like, we're not pursuing the best rider in the world. That doesn't look great. And it just all kind of, it seemed like the vibes were bad. The vibes were off. And then I was surprised to see Vollering look so off the pace. Like, I don't think I've seen her look like that in years.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely impacted the outcome of the race, I think. And then for as long as they're stuck working together, we're not going to have, you know, I think their ability to be effective professionally is diminished. These are colleagues who are not very collegial.
I do think it's kind of weird. I mean, can you imagine if like Tom Pidcock and Gana were screaming F and B at each other at the end of a race? It would be big news. I think it's kind of, I feel like the media wants them to be friends or wants some good feel good story. It's like they are not friends. I mean, you can just tell. You can tell they don't really care for each other, which is awesome. I just wish that was embraced more and that they were allowed to kind of be, you know, like a Froome Thomas. The relationship is breaking down and we're watching it and it's very fun.
Yeah, Hino, Le Mans, Lance, Contador, it has that type of vibe to
it. Oh, man. And I remember that. I think other coworkers of mine maybe don't remember it so fondly, but that was such a fun tour, the 2009 tour when they were just openly fighting.
Yeah.
And so Basque Country. So I turn on, it's a Monday, it's a big stage race. You got Jonas Vingegaard, you got Primoz Roglic, you got Remco Evenepoel in a time trial to start the tour of the Basque Country. This is going to be awesome. I turn it on. They've all gone before the TV coverage starts. So we're not able to watch them. And then I'm going through Twitter. You see that Remco crashed in the first corner, looked really kind of unstable on his bike. Tom Pidcock is being carried off the bus like a child because he's maybe broken his hip in the recon. What is going on at Ineos and TT Recons, by the way? Someone needs to look into this. Maybe Joe Rogan. Primoz Roglic goes the wrong way, still wins the race by 14 seconds, and then Jonas looks okay, and then Sepp Kuss looks really off the pace. I'm going to put the message out there now. Don't pay no minds to Sepp Kuss. He looks out of shape. This is the Sepp Kuss playbook. Like, he will be in shape when it matters. The man is not a great one-week stage racer, never has been. Let Sepp have his process. But it was a wild opening stage. Primoz looks back after the Paris-Nice disappointment. Everyone who was putting dirt in his grave. Was there like there's the pro wrestler who would like pop up out of the coffin, the Undertaker? That's Primoz right here. He's going to destroy everyone at this race, but just keep an eye on it. I'll be monitoring the situation. I'm excited to see how him, Vingegaard and Evenepoel and not Pidcock do this week. I think this could kind of tell us a lot about how the dynamics will be at the tour, even if the fitness isn't a one-for-one ratio. And obviously things will be different when Pogacar shows up. And also, I heard today that Wout van Aert is going to race the Giro d'Italia. So everyone said he's not even going to be healthy enough for the tour. You're wrong. He wants to collect that €2 million start fee, broken sternum or not.
Who wouldn't want to? I have to say that Roglic going off course seems like a bit of a tip of the hat to the spirit of gravel as well.
It was very gravelly. There was a car. He had to like dodge a car out on the course. So
perfect.
Could have been a BWR Kansas. And then it was very ambiguous where the finish line was.
They did have a train stoppage during Flanders as well.
Yes.
We talk about that.
And did you know that? So did you know this rule? I didn't know this because I've been stopped in breakaways by a train before. If the peloton catches you, you get to go on with they have to wait and give you the gap you had. If they don't catch you, then, and that's how I caught Botas at BWR train crossing. But if they don't catch you, it's just lost time. Sorry, folks, you had a 4-minute lead. Now you have a 1-minute lead. Like, that's a crazy rule that train crossings, and they often do play a too big of a part, I'd say, in Flanders and Roubaix, especially at Roubaix. We've seen multiple train crossings where people have won the race or been just, and then like a few years later disqualified because they slipped through under the high speed train crossing rails, which is not a good idea. Don't do that. So I'm sick of these trains playing such a big part in these races. Let's get a hard and fast rule about this.
Yeah, I agree. Let's tune this up. Well, Spencer, I got a slat. I got to go work on helping the world sleep better. But this has been a fun chat. I'm looking forward to seeing what comes this week from the spirit of gravel and the world tour.
It's sad to see road racing has stooped so low to put on a gravel race this weekend. they're clearly copying the U.S. gravel trend with this Paris-Roubaix. So it's shameful to see. That's a joke, obviously. This race has been going on for like 150 years.
Couple years.
Thank you, Andrew. And we are excited for Sunday. And we'll be back to talk about probably Matthew Vanderpoel's monument run. We'll see how it goes.